This podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
In recent years, the patient voice in healthcare and drug development has emerged. From FDA initiatives such as patient-focused drug development, enhancing the use of patient-reported outcomes, and diversity and inclusion in advocacy, the role of the patient has really grown. Listening to the patient voice helps address the presence of unmet medical needs, including the recognition of invisible illnesses, or those that are not identifiable, such as many mental illnesses and chronic pain illnesses. One such disease is myalgic encephalomyelitis, also known as chronic fatigue syndrome. For brevity, these illnesses are abbreviated to ME-CFS. I'm Kinari Shah, a research fellow at DIA. Today, I'm joined by Jennifer Brea, an independent documentary filmmaker and director of Shella Films. A graduate of Princeton University, Jennifer was in the midst of doctoral studies at Harvard University when the sudden onset of ME-CFS left her bedridden and unable to continue her degree. Her journey inspired her into advocacy work and to create the documentary Unrest, which won a special jury prize at Sundance Film Festival 2017. She has since spoken about her journey and experiences on platforms such as the Today Show, at TED events, and also at DIA's Medical Affairs and Scientific Communications Conference this past March. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thanks for having me.
For our listeners who may not be familiar with you, would you like to share your personal journey with ME-CFS and patient advocacy?
My journey began in 2011. I was a graduate student doing a PhD at Harvard. And after a trip to East Africa, I came back and became suddenly ill with what seemed like an acute viral infection. I thought it was just a really bad virus. But after having a really high fever for 10 days, when the fever broke, I remember trying to get up out of bed, and I was so dizzy that I had to hug the walls to get to the bathroom. I went to the doctor, and they sort of said, well, you had a viral infection, and that was sort of the only explanation they could offer. But as sort of the year wore on, I kept getting infection after infection, and with each hit, started feeling worse and worse and worse. Until a little over a year later, I became completely bedridden and had a whole assortment of different neurological symptoms, gastrointestinal symptoms. I would sometimes have the sensation that my brain and spine were burning, my muscles were weak, and really it seemed like my whole body was being affected. And I went to doctor after doctor, and they would say things like, well, you're really young, there shouldn't be anything wrong with you, or, you know, our tests came back normal, therefore you're probably fine, even though I was becoming more and more disabled and completely losing my life. And it was really going online and finding other patients like me with my same onset history, same set of symptoms, that I began to understand that I was part of this much larger community of people living with what is commonly known as chronic fatigue syndrome, what we prefer to call myalgic encephalomyelitis, or ME. And what I found was that the core symptom that we all share is not fatigue. It's something that's actually qualitatively different and objectively different that we're able to sort of measure now. And that's this sort of symptom or phenomenon called post-exertional malaise. And that's also not the best word for it, but it's essentially this kind of crashing that we get after physical or cognitive exertion, where all of our symptoms get worse. Sometimes it can be so bad that I wouldn't even be able to move or lift my head. And in addition to this worsening of our symptoms, it sort of triggers this whole inflammatory cascade. And so you get inflammation, you also get lactic acid in your brain, your muscles. So something very, very different to fatigue. And it was really hard to describe and really hard to find help, because there were so few specialists in the country. And so I turned to the patient community. And there I learned that there are people, many of whom have been sick, homebound, bedridden for decades. And that's when I really started to conceive of this as a social justice issue. And like me, many of them, you know, I was initially diagnosed by my neurologist with conversion disorder, which essentially, who didn't explain my neurological symptoms, and so said, told me they were being caused by some distant trauma that I even remember. And I found in my community so many people who've had those same experiences who, you know, go to doctors and are told that it's, quote, all in their head.
So Jennifer has been kind enough to provide us with a soundbite from her film Unrest of a patient. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the 60-second clip that you provided?
As I mentioned, I went online and I found this whole community of people who had been similarly abandoned by medicine, had had similar difficulty finding care. And I think part of it is that this disease is very hard to understand unless you live it, meaning you have it, or you live in the home with the patient who has it. And this is true of many, quote, invisible illnesses. And part of the reason is that our symptoms can be so variable. So for some people, especially if you're on the mild to moderate end of the spectrum, you might be able to go out in public and look completely normal for an hour or two, but then you go home and you crash and you might be stuck in bed for the next couple of days or even weeks or months. And so people often don't see us when we're at our worst, because when we crash, we literally disappear from our lives, from society. And so I thought, okay, well, this neglect of this disease that has gone on for so long must be in part because it is so hard to see. And it's hard to be, you know, in our homes, in our bedrooms with us in the middle of the night when we're having our worst symptoms. And so I really wanted to try to find a way to visualize that and to bring people into that experience by going into our homes with cameras and documenting those moments that the rest of the world, let alone our doctors, rarely get to see. And so that was really the impetus behind making Unrest.
Hi, Jen.
Hi.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you, Jessica. Happy birthday to you.
You get one. Come on. Excellent.
I get to my birthday, and for me, that's a really difficult date because I think it's another year in bed. I remember my 16th birthday in bed, and remember my 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th, 21st.
Pushed it up.
I made it into a chair for a couple of seconds for my 22nd, but other than that, I was in bed.
Do you remember when and how you really discovered the power of storytelling through filmmaking and your original love for filmmaking, if you want to talk about that?
I've always loved movies, and I remember going to the theater with my mom, and we might go 1 o'clock in the afternoon to stay and watch three films. And so cinema was always a part of my life, but I was always more of a writer. And when I first got sick, I completely lost the ability to write. I remember if I would try to write two sentences of an email, I would then crash and more or less pass out for several hours from the exertion, like two sentences. I tried writing and it was really, really difficult. And that's really why I turned to film in the beginning as a medium of expression. So I spent a lot of time those first couple of years being bedridden, just looking at photographs on Pinterest and watching videos because that was all I could do. So that's a large part of why I chose film. But it was also because I think that film is a medium that really allows for a kind of empathy and immediacy that is unique to that medium. I thought it was a really good way to, as much as possible, bring people to this experience. Of course, when I first started making the film, I was bedridden. And so when you can't travel, can't hold a camera, it was a pretty daunting task trying to figure out, okay, how am I going to make a documentary, let alone one set on, you know, two continents in three countries. And so I ended up really through a lot of just sending emails when I could, connecting with producers and cinematographers and their filmmakers in the places where I wanted to shoot, and developed a kind of global producing team to help me make the film. I would then also use essentially Skype and a platform called Ustream, and we were able to live stream the camera feed. So literally what the camera was seeing as it was seeing it. which let me both preview the interviews that I was doing and monitor what our DP was shooting, whether they were in California or the UK or Denmark. And so it really was a film that was made from bed. In terms of the power of filmmaking, I mean, I think it was really, once we premiered the film at Sundance, and I remember this woman who was at the premiere, so literally the first public screening we'd ever had, and she was just someone who loved film and was at the film festival. And at Sundance, many films sell out, and so you go on the wait list to grab a spot if someone doesn't show up. And so she was just on the wait list. She had no idea what the film was about, was just walking in to have an experience of the film. And during the Q&A after the film, she stood up and she said, "Oh my God, that's me. I had no idea what was wrong with me. This is my life. This is what I've been living. And now I know." And so that was a really powerful first experience in terms of seeing how this film, once it was out in theaters and broadcast, how it might help patients who are searching for answers find their way to an answer. And then I think the other moment really came when we started, one, when patients started sharing the film with their friends and family. And, you know, again, this is a very hard disease to understand unless you live in the home. And now people could share the film with their siblings or friends from college and have them start to understand what they may have been trying to describe in words, but I think it's really hard to convey. And I know a lot of people who were estranged from their loved ones, where unrest became a way to reconnect and to heal some of those ruptured relationships where, you know, a lot of people might have drifted away. I mean, one of the things everyone says about this disease when you get it is that it's not like getting cancer or MS or a condition that is well understood, where people kind of rally around you, bring you lasagna. Patients often have the experience of being abandoned because the medical community has largely abandoned them, because oftentimes the doctors will say, well, this patient's not really sick, or, you know, it's quote in their head. So I think the film really helped with that. It's also been an incredible experience screening it for doctors and for medical students. Doctors don't often have the opportunity to talk about what it's like for them practicing medicine under the constraints of a 10 or 20 minute visit, what it's like when they can't help a patient, and patients often don't have the chance to speak honestly about what they're experiencing and the ways that they might have felt let down, to be frank. And so because you have doctors in a room with patients, but those patients are not patients of those doctors, there's a kind of way that people can kind of connect around some of these issues in a really honest way that I think really surprised me and was really quite beautiful. As one doctor who saw the film at Sundance said, you know, I came and I thought I was seeing a film about health, and actually this is a film about love. And it is, in many ways. It's a love story about me and my husband, but also about brothers and sisters and parents and their children. And also, I think the love that we patients have for one another and for this community and for others who share our experience. And so it's been just really wonderful to see the way that filmmaking allows us to approach experiences like this in a totally different way.
I'm really glad you shared that story about the woman at the Q&A at Sundance. And I think that just really speaks to that human need to be able to relate to someone else. And I think especially for patients, the community piece of that is so important when going through a chronic illness or really any kind of truly debilitating illness. So transitioning from talking about your film, I wanted to know more about how you pursued advocacy work and how patients can really pursue advocacy work in the best ways.
Early on in my illness, I saw a documentary film called How to Survive a Plague, which is directed by David France. It's a wonderful film, and it's about the history of the early years of ACT UP and of the AIDS movement, in particular in New York. And it was part of my, I guess, evolution to health and access to health care as not just a question of science, but also one of social justice and of a social question. And obviously in that story of the AIDS epidemic, so much of the early neglect, disinterest, lack of urgency was around the stigma around homosexuality, and also was compounded by race and class and all these other things that we don't normally think of as being related to medicine and healthcare, even though obviously they very directly are. And so it was a big eye-opening experience to me. And even though the situation of gay men in New York in the 80s and 90s is so different in so many important ways from what patients with ME face today, there are a lot of echoes and similarities as well. So I ended up reaching out to Peter Staley, who is a longtime AIDS activist and is a protagonist in the film. And we started to have some conversations about when no one's paying attention to your community and no one thinks that what you're going through is particularly urgent or important. Like, how do you put your disease on the agenda? And how do you do it in particular when 25% of patients, you know, are homebound and bedridden, can't even leave their homes, when people have profound physical and cognitive disabilities? So we started talking back and forth. I ended up doing a kind of community call with him to sort of interview him and learn about his experience. And it was really out of that ME Action was born, out of those conversations. And a part of it was an experiment to try to see, okay, we're this community that exists largely online, and we exist online because it's a way to connect with other people, even though we can't show up in person. How can we take that and transform it into an advantage, that connectivity and that online community? And how can we mobilize and leverage that passion strategically in order to achieve change? And so our organization is a global grassroots organization that is primarily patient-led, patient-driven, along with allies who are caregivers, our families, doctors and researchers. And a lot of it really is about awareness, education, medical community outreach, and also political advocacy in order to create better policies to support the lives of people with ME and to fund research. And so, you know, I think that a lot of disease spaces have more traditional foundations for research or top-down organizations for advocacy, and so do we. But I really saw just how much people in our community wanted to contribute to fighting for and changing their own lives. And also that so many of us, we had lives before as lawyers or doctors or mothers or teachers, and that the world often doesn't know how to, you know, use your skills and use your experience unless it can employ you 40 hours a week. And so, you know, we wanted to say, okay, if you have 10 minutes, if you have 3 hours, whatever it is that you have, you can log on and you can help contribute to the movement. So much of my advocacy on a personal level and my filmmaking was about finding purpose and meaning when I had lost everything in my life that I thought made me me. You know, I was a PhD student, I was studying statistics and political economy and had defined so much of my sense of worth by my ability to read and write and think. And suddenly I could do none of those things. And I spent a long time wondering what the point was of living anymore and what it would mean to live if I no longer had anything to offer to my immediate family, let alone the world. And so I think that that experience gave me insight into how important it is to still be able to work and to do things that have value and impact. And this community has really come together and achieved some truly extraordinary things. We just passed in the Senate just last week the first resolution on ME/CFS in our community's history. We also passed a motion in the UK Parliament. We've engaged, you know, hundreds of doctors through our UNRESTS continuing medical education program. So if you're in the US, you can watch the film for credit. And so much of that has really been about the patients mobilizing their friends and family to go out and take action. We have a day of rallies and protests every May, which is our awareness month. And this year, 85 cities on 6 continents, that is every inhabited continent, participated. So we're really building a movement. And I think that, you know, obviously, if you are listening to this and you have ME/CFS or you know somebody who does, they can get involved by going to meaction.net. But I do think that this is a model that any disease community can learn from or adopt in part. And I think that when patients get mobilized and get active, there is so much change that can happen, and it can happen even faster. That's why we created the organization, and I'm really excited to sort of see what we're able to do in the coming years.
Sounds like the past month has been really busy for the organization and really fruitful too, so that's really nice to hear. You touched on a lot of information about health equity and sort of the social determinants of health that might play into a disease not being recognized. So what is the importance of applying an equity lens to patient advocacy work, and can that same equity lens be applied to patient-focused drug development?
You go on PubMed and you look at the research literature, and you might think that what is there reflects the best of our knowledge and efforts that we're able to achieve in this moment in time, right, in science and technology, as though it's sort of an unbiased reflection of human knowledge. But as we know, so much of what we know depends on the questions we choose to ask, the ways that we frame them, and the science that we invest in, because science is costly and drug development is costly. And so I absolutely think that a part of why this disease and other diseases that have some symptom overlap, like fibromyalgia, like postural orthostatic tachycardia or POTS, like Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which is a connective tissue disorder, all of these conditions have a very strong female bias. So between 75 and 90% female. And I do think that is a part of why these conditions have been ignored. There's a tendency, and we know from research that there is a tendency to ascribe psychological explanations to women's symptoms. And we do that more readily than we do for men. And I don't know why that is. I'm sure we could all think of some ideas about why that might be. But I do think that bias does exist, and it has harmed both men and women with this disease. There are other so many examples in the history of science and medicine of racial bias and class bias and sexual orientation bias and rural urban geography bias all playing a role in the conditions we focus on, the way that we approach them, and who has access to treatments once they are available. So I think it's always important to look at the state of the world and to try to think more deeply about how is it that we came to this place. I think that this disease space has for a long time on the map of human disease been a bit of a therapy dragons, don't go there. And there's this weird sort of chicken and egg problem where people think there's nothing to find, so they don't look. And because no one looks, they don't find anything. And we've been kind of stuck in that cycle for a really long time. And I think for anybody working in pharma, what I would say is, well, yeah, and at the same time, you're talking about an unmet need. And whenever there's unmet need, there's also incredible opportunity. And in terms of people who meet the criteria for ME/CFS, and that's a population of about 17 to 30 million worldwide. And if you were to also throw in some of the other conditions that I mentioned, you know, you're talking about tens upon tens of millions of people. And so I think that there's a really, really great opportunity to find solutions to improve symptoms that are specific to this disease, as well as potentially find a cure. And what I would also say is that in recent years, and in particular the last 5 to 10 years, there has been so much progress in terms of the basic research. There are some really great groups working at Stanford and Harvard in Norway, Australia, Germany, and the UK that are all looking at the sort of genetic and biochemical determinants and impacts of this disease. So this concept of crashing that I talked about before, which is a hallmark of this disease, PEM, as we call it, post-social malaise, we now are starting to be able to quantify it on a molecular level and to also use brain imaging to understand what happens in the brains of patients after they exert themselves beyond their limits. And we're starting to find evidence of, in the metabolomics, of a tendency to switch, you know, too early into anaerobic metabolism and to have partial blocks in pyruvate dehydrogenase enzyme. We're finding evidence of autoimmunity, evidence of brain inflammation. And so there's just really a lot of exciting research happening now that is starting to objectively measure what patients have been describing for decades. And the evidence was always there. Like we're made of flesh and bone and cells and mitochondria. And so what we experience can be measured, but you can't measure what you don't choose to measure, and you can't find the answers to questions that you never ask. And so that's really been my message. And I guess I would just say that I'm really excited to report that we're starting to learn a lot. We actually just came out with a new research summary, which you can also find on our website, really highlighting the different kind of strands of inquiry that have emerged over the last several years. It's still probably early for drug developments, but there's a phase 3 clinical trial happening in Mestinon. So about a third of patients with this disease have acetylcholine receptor autoantibodies, as I did. And it seems like a subset are responders to Mastinon, which is an acetylcholinesterase inhibitor. So there's a phase 3 clinical trial happening now at Harvard and Brigham and Women's on Mastinon and exercise intolerance. And we know anecdotally that there are drugs that seem to help a subset of people, but we won't be able to get patients wide access to those drugs until we're able to do clinical trials and understand which treatments are most likely to benefit which patients. So I think there's a lot of fruitful work that could be done there and that I hope will be done there in the next coming years.
If you or anybody in the ME community have participated in any kind of patient-focused drug development, or how you think ME-CFS can be better recognized in patient-focused drug development?
The FDA did an amazing voice of the patient sort of process maybe a decade ago now. And it was really incredible because it was the most accurate description of the disease and its experiences that I have ever read. And the reason why was because it really was reflecting the voice of the patient, the experiences we have, the symptoms we have, and, you know, not filtered through a doctor or a researcher. And so I think there's a lot of power and potential in that. But I'm going to be honest that I don't know what patient-focused drug development is. If you can describe it to me, what you mean by that.
So based on guidances from the FDA, patient-focused drug development is an FDA-led initiative to use a systematic approach incorporating the patient voice into drug development and regulatory decision-making. And so far, this has included things like disease-specific meetings with the FDA to provide all stakeholders an opportunity to hear the patient voice when developing a medical product.
I think what I would say about that is I think it's absolutely invaluable. I think that you learn things and save a lot of time and provide better care when you involve patients in the process. And involving, I think, means not just having folks show up and asking what they think, but actually having patients be involved in the framing and crafting of any process. Because I think that there's a lot that just gets missed when you rely on the research literature or secondhand accounts, because not everything that is empirically true or a people experience gets translated into text. So I've had multiple experiences of the textbooks just being wrong or incomplete when it comes to our symptoms, for example, or the way that we experience them. So I think it's definitely important. I think what I would say, or also just like what our most pressing problems are, you know, a doctor might be especially focused on treating a specific symptom like pain or sleep, which can be big problems for people with this disease, when actually in reality, there's something else that people are ignoring that actually is a much more debilitating symptom. Those are all reasons why it's important to have patients involved. I would say about this disease that we would appreciate any drug development. There are a few startups that are doing clinical trials of novel compounds, which is exciting. And case of Mastinon, a trial of a drug that has been out for quite some time. And I think we learn a lot from those trials and experiments. And I would just say it's worth looking into this disease space. I'm sure you've heard of this disease, but so much has happened now, and we want that partnership. We want that collaboration. And so if you know, you're someone listening and you go and you look at the science and think there's something that you're developing in your company or have developed in the past that might be applicable to this patient population, we'd love to hear from you, and we'd love to get you hooked in with our researchers.
Listening to Jennifer, the patient voice is really important in understanding diseases that aren't so visible and aren't so commonly found. And I just like to thank Jennifer again for joining us. And I would really encourage you to give her documentary a look. It's an extremely powerful depiction of how important the patient voice is and how important it is to really understand and listen to people suffering from these diseases.
Thank you so much, Canary. And I will just repeat that if you go to unrest.film, and you are a medical provider, you can get CE credit for watching the film. So now you have two reasons to watch. Okay, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciated this discussion.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.